If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
For us, we are just laser focused on doing an amazing job and looking after the people and the businesses that operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing sector and doing that with real care and class. And like we're very, very focused on doing that. And actually, if we do that really, really well, we're pretty sure everything else will take care of itself.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. Today, we're joined by Andrew Mears. Andrew is the CEO of Lead Candidate, a business he co-founded in 2020 to champion the companies and careers in the global life sciences sector.
We are super niche in terms that we only operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing sector. So when we talk about life sciences, businesses who say that they are an expert in life sciences, well, I'm yet to find an expert in life sciences because that's a multi...
It's a huge area.
I mean, how can you be an expert in life sciences, right? I struggle with that concept.
Andrew actually started his career in HR before making the leap to the recruitment industry. And for the last 16 years, he's grown national and international practices.
And I remember Fiona saying very distinctly, if all we can do is create a pricing structure that is a percentage of an annual salary split into three installments, then we have failed. We are going to...
Because that's what everyone's doing.
So everyone does. So everyone does. Everyone does. She went, I started in business in late 1980s, early 1990s. That's what they were doing then. And it's not changed.
Andrew, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, Mark, thanks for having me. It's great to be speaking to you.
So you're actually just down the road from me in Newcastle, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I am, yes, just down the road.
Have you been to Edinburgh before?
I have. Spent a lot of time in Edinburgh. It's an hour and 15 minutes on the train, so it's a common trip for us just on a weekend to say, right, load the family and the dog into the train and we're going to head up the road. So
awesome. So I'm actually closer to you than that because I'm in Dunbar in East Lothian, halfway.
Yeah.
Well, almost to Berwick, basically.
Yeah, well, Dunbar, so we have somebody who works for us who's originally from Berwick. My operations director, his mother lives in Berwick, so we have lots of connections to Berwick and Dunbar. And and one of my bucket lists is to go to Archer Field, which isn't very far away from you. Yeah, I'd quite like to play golf there. Yeah,
fantastic. So I originally found you because you were on a Recruiter magazine list of the 50 fastest growing companies in the UK. And I started following your content on LinkedIn, and that's how I reached out. I think the article in particular, or the LinkedIn post, was debunking the myth that recruitment is a young man's
game. Young man's game, yeah.
That spoke to me as a 52-year-old. And so I reached out, so I'm glad we're finally doing this.
That definitely got a few responses. That post, lots of people who are in a similar age group to you and I. Sending me messages to say, yep, I feel the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I'm better than I ever have been. I finally am figuring some stuff out, right?
Exactly.
And So listen, you've had a kind of non-linear journey in your career. Tell me about starting out in HR and how did that shape your view of recruitment and why did you eventually cross over to the agency side?
It's a great question. And so when I left university in 97, I did a degree in business, which kind of gave me lots of tools to do different things. And I decided that human resources was something I found quite interesting, the whole kind of organizational psychology and sort of ecosystemic management and what have you. I really found that interesting in my final year. And I found myself being interviewed by a human resources director just for a job that I was going to get some money through the door. Basically, it was to be a mortgage processor of all things. And I was interviewed by the human resources director and I just thought, hey, I'm just going to go for it and tell her that I want my career is to be human resources. And she called me up the next day and said, listen, you'd be a lousy mortgage processor, but I actually have a role in my team and I'd like you to come in and meet the team. And that's how I ended up in human resources. So I started my CIPD training. and went on a classic HR career. I worked for EY, big professional services. Then I moved into retail. Then I moved into automotive manufacturing with a big American company called Magna. And I absolutely loved my time there. But I think when I got to Magna and I was in kind of a management role and being exposed to management decisions and leadership of a group, I think that's where I kind of found my sort of, that's what I enjoyed. And I enjoyed figuring out the human elements of the strategy of the business and how do we design the organization to be more effective and get involved in some of those things. And a business that provided services to me, a privately owned business in Newcastle, basically started, I built a relationship with them. They provided services to me.
This is a recruitment business.
This is a recruitment
about.
Business.
Okay.
Yep. And they were a customer. I was their customer. And it got to a point where I was kind of, I couldn't go any further in the organization that I was in. And they'd offered me a couple of opportunities where I could move elsewhere in the UK, which I didn't want to do. And so I started thinking about a career move. And so I spoke to these guys and these guys came to me and said, hey, well, why wouldn't you come and work with us? Because we're building this business. We're a kind of boutique sort of, executive search type business, premium, high quality service, high touch. And honestly, when I met the owner of the business, he could have been selling pens, Mark. I think I would have gone and worked for him. I just bought into him and his ideals and what he wanted to do. And so I made the leap. And I also said to my partner, who's now my wife, if it all goes horribly wrong, I've got nearly a decade in human resources that I can fall back on. So it's kind of like, it's like no risk. But to answer the other part of your question, what was my impression of the recruitment industry? It wasn't great. And so that was one of the big things I wrestled with, was I'm kind of becoming gamekeeper turned poacher here. And crossing over to the other side, it's kind of the whole Luke Skywalker thing and Anakin Skywalker and, becoming Darth Vader and all that sort of stuff. And it was lots of my peers in human resources were like, what are you doing? You're not a sales guy. Like, why would you want to do that? And I think what I realized very quickly was actually a lot of the skills and experiences that I'd built, I'm not a sales guy, never have been, and don't ever sort of think I will ever describe myself as a sales guy per se. But what I am is a solutions guy. I solve problems for people. And actually, that as I learned in my career in recruitment, that's actually a big part of what we do.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say, and I've heard my friend Greg Savage describe sales this way, that professional selling is problem solving, consulting, providing solutions, advising, and so on. So I want to ask, though, because if you're in a managerial position in HR for a big company, and then you're joining an independent, although very successful recruitment business, normally in recruitment, it's lower base salaries, and then there's a commission element, right? And so was that a concern? Because I'm guessing you took a pay cut to join the recruitment agency.
I did. Yeah, I did. I did. It was marginal. It wasn't huge, but it was a cut. But the earning potential was obviously greater. So the incentive structure around that was kind of bought into. And I sort of worked in my own mind, I worked the numbers out to say, right, okay, yeah. And what I was very clear about was I was in a management role. If you will, where in the automotive business, but this wasn't going to be. This was an individual contributor role. This was me effectively starting again, and kind of as you sort of said, that non-linear career. But I was in my own mind, I think I was astute enough to realize that, and I think that comes from my dad. Genuinely, like my dad. Like when I left university, all my buddies went off to do grad schemes in London and stuff like that, and sort of like my old man was very much of the opinion of, well, if you need to get a role where you're at the bottom and you work your way up, then that's what you do, and you earn your stripes and you evolve through that sort of career structure in that way. And that's what I've done all the way through my career. That is literally all that I've done. So when my friends were going off to become, getting 30 £1,000 a year in a grad scheme, I think my starting salary was £8,995.
That sounds about right. Mine was £10,500 my first recruitment job.
Yeah, yeah. And so that, but that was when I was like sort of my first HR job, and I was a bit further by the time I got into the recruitment job, but nevertheless, but so it was a consideration, absolutely. And, but again, for me, I think I was joining a business, and we'll maybe come to this later. I was joining a business where while they wanted to incentivize you to succeed and ultimately earn good bonus, the whole philosophy and culture of the business was one about quality and not falling into the trap of being another transactional recruiter like everybody else on the marketplace, be something different. And so that was kind of my learning of recruitment, was very much, you know, every candidate you talk to is a future customer. You know, they deserve the same amount of respect as the people who are hiring them. You know, you look after those people, you manage their expectations, even if you can't help them. Even if you can't help them, you still provide them a level of care. And so I kind of had that in my, I suppose, my ethos. That's how I learned recruitment. Was it was a very, it was all about mutually reciprocal and beneficial relationships, and how you manage them and the care you take with them is the thing that will support you in your career.
Awesome. Yeah, that is definitely jives with my philosophy. And so you spent 11 years growing. The thing I love about the recruitment industry is that if it's in the right environment, it is a meritocracy, right? So you really can start at the bottom and work your way up. And it's based on your, obviously, you know, the right values, behaviors, and ultimately results as well, performance. Excuse me. And so looking at your LinkedIn profile, looks like you progressed and you did very well. You led teams, you led international teams and practice areas. So what was the point at which you decided that you were going to launch Lead Candidate? How did that come about?
So my journey wasn't straightforward. I'll jump straight to Lead Candidate. So a couple of things that drove my decision were a bit of a COVID midlife crisis, Mark. I think it's fair enough to say. You know, maybe not an uncommon story. But I was the chief operating officer of a multi-faceted recruitment group, privately owned. I think at the time we were maybe, I don't know, 25, 26 million turnover, something like that. It was a paycheck. It was good, but I think I realized that I wasn't satisfied. And I think the environment probably wasn't right for me. And I think, you know, it was funny, after I left, there was a lot of people sort of said to me, you know, we always felt that you didn't fit in that culture. But I was there, you know, 6 years, I think 7 years. I was there. I wasn't there. I don't think I've ever, my early career, maybe every 2 years, but my recruitment career, 11 years, six, 7 years, you know, I don't jump. I don't jump around. And, my wife had been very sick. So about 8 years ago, my wife had contracted viral encephalitis.
Oh my God.
Which was a brain injury, basically. And she had all the symptoms of a brain injury. You know, her nerve structure on the left-hand side of her face was destroyed. She was paralyzed on the left-hand side of her face. She has lasting health issues as a consequence of that. And it gives you a new perspective on life. And it reminds you how far, and then COVID happened. And then you were like, wow, this can happen and stop the world. And it did. It stopped the world. And so I just, I remember walking into to see the chairman and sitting down with him and just having a very very honest conversation with him, and said, I'm leaving. I'm going to go and set my own business up, I think, and go and work on some consultancy things and figure out what I want to do. And literally the day after I told him that, which was, you know, for a lot of people sort of saying you're mad because you're walking away from security, whatever, and you know, mortgage, and you know, I've got a young family, all that responsibilities. Literally the day after that happened, a very good friend of mine called me. He was living in Boston at the time. A guy called Roman Segal. I've known Roman over a decade, and he works in the pharma and bio outsourcing sector. He owns a PR agency in that space, or did. And he rang me and said, "Listen, I've got an idea for a business, and it's in your space. You know, what we're seeing in my customers in this world are, you know, constantly asking me for recommendations and referrals and people because they want to hire in their teams across all functions and all levels." And he said, "What's become clear is when I asked them, well, why aren't you using a recruiter to help you with this? The response that he got was, you know, just the same response, that there isn't a high quality recruiter out there who works in this space, who, you know, gets our business like you do, Roman, and your team do, you know, that personal service, that really embedded partnership model just doesn't exist. We don't think it exists." And so Roman sort of came to me and said, "So I think there's an opportunity." He said, "But I don't know enough about the talent acquisition space and what you do." He said, "But every time I talk to you about what you do, you talk like what my customers are telling me is missing." He said, "But you know, so he said, I'm trying to figure out whether I've got it wrong or they've got it wrong." And so I did a bit of desk-based research with him, pulled together some ideas about the, and did my research, looked at who the competitors were, looked at who the businesses were all over the world, US and Europe and into Asia. And Roman was right, and these customers were right. I couldn't find anyone who really stood out as a high quality. There's lots of businesses who had, you know, they're good transactional contingent recruiters who all had a very clear business model. They all had a particular demographic. They all had a different particular set of skill sets, but they were classic 360 degree recruiter type business models. And that's fine. You know, there's a place for all those businesses. That's fine. That's never going to be a super high touch premium product offering. It's not, because the business model, I think the business, to have that business model and to deliver that level of high touch, it's difficult. And so I kind of presented this research to him and to Fiona Cruikshank, who is the one of the other non-exec who has built a couple of CDMOs that operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing space very successfully. She's a pharmacist, and she is an operator in the space, and still to this day, and a wonderful human being, who's revered as a philanthropist and angel investor. And so I presented my findings to them, and then they sort of said to me, "Oh, hey, well, do you know anyone who would want to get involved with us in this, who operates in talent acquisition and might want to be the CEO and do this business?" And I was kind of sitting there going, "Well, I can think of a few people," and the two of them were just laughing basically, because they're obviously talking about me. And so I realized that Roman had just done a really clever sales ploy to get me involved in the project. And what I realized very quickly was, in Roman and Fiona, is two people that very, very strong moral compasses, very high levels of integrity. Every business they've been involved with has been a phenomenal success. And so you're surrounding yourself with the right types of people, which again is something that I've kind of learned through my career, is you need to surround yourself with great people. And if you surround yourself with great people, anything is possible. So that's a bit of a long-winded story to how did Lead Candidate exist. That's how it came into existence.
All right. Awesome. That's a great quote, by the way. If you surround yourself with the right people, anything is possible.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. So that was 2020.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot to get into here, because the life sciences sector has had a roller coaster since then, like really up during COVID and the couple of years after, and then, you know, back down again. So we can get into all that. But you mentioned business model. So I just want to understand, what is the business model? How do you engage with customers? What does that look like? What's the solutions, and how do you price that?
Okay, let's unpick that. So when we, so I've kind of, through my career, I've always been, when I was in my sort of boutique days in Newcastle, where I was 11 years, I was a retained search guy. Everything we did was retained search. And so when we entered a new market, so when I first started working in the Benelux market, proposition was always retained. And so I've always been that guy. I think I've only done maybe 20% of my career has ever been contingent. The rest of it has been real retained search and high quality retained search. So often competing with the Shreks, you know, but also then building that model down into the levels that the Shreks aren't interested in. So do C-suite, but then also build the functional teams up. So I knew it was going to be something that was going to be like that. I always remember Fiona saying to me, actually, I'll come back to what Fiona said to me, but when we were doing the session to create what the business model was going to be, we were very clear that it needed to be something that was built around partnership. And the kind of businesses that we felt that we could really help were probably the businesses who were maybe a little bit smaller, who were on a change journey. So we made a kind of conscious decision that the kind of organizations that we'd want to work with were probably sub 500 million turnover. They were probably private equity backed, or privately owned. But the one thing that they all had that was consistent was they had a strong change agenda to be delivered. And we felt confident that there was enough market to look at those types of businesses. And they were probably a bit resource light. So they were quite lean in terms of their operating structure. So they may have a human resources function, but they probably wouldn't have a talent acquisition function. And they had an amount of work, a volume of work that needed some resource and proper resource put around it. So that was the first, that was the kind of the nuts and bolts of the business model. They're the kind of people we're going to go and talk to. We are super niche in terms that we only operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing sector. So when we talk about life sciences, you know, businesses who say that they are an expert in life sciences, well, I'm yet to find an expert in life sciences because that's a multi...
It's a huge area.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how can you be an expert in life sciences, right? I mean, I struggle with that concept. So we picked a niche within a niche, if you like.
Yes.
That's our niche. And we did that very deliberately because Roman and Fiona had so much depth of knowledge in that sector. It was logical that we would do that.
Can I just press pause here for a second, Andrew, because... And just recap on a couple of key things that you said. So first of all, I agree 100% in finding your niche within a niche and being very clear in delineating the sorts of, like the profile of your, we call it ideal client avatar. Some people call it an ICP, ideal client profile,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you go too broad, like life sciences in general, or even biotech or whatever, then that's not really specializing, right? As you said, it's still very broad. It's like saying I specialize in IT. Well, that encompasses lots of different types of businesses, right? And so, whereas if you narrow it down to an aperture that you could realistically be the leader in that space, right? And you can become, you could really be established and dominate in that space. And I love how clear you were in defining that. So it was less than 500 million, most likely, in revenue. It was either privately owned or PE backed. They were going through a change process and they probably didn't have a TA function yet. So do you remember how many companies are in that? So that's called the TAM, total addressable market, right? Do you know how many companies fit?
It was difficult to start with because I think what we realized quickly was it was probably in the thousands. And if you look globally, it was in the thousands. And then one of the things that we did, which I think is relevant to your question, was about our service offering. Like, what are we going to do? Well, we said, well, why don't we ask the market? Because we had the market data. We had the companies. So I think when we built the original sort of target market, as you described it, I think it was maybe 500 companies that were across the pharma and bio outsourcing sector that we felt fell into the category. And, you know, it was really useful, right? Because Roman's networks were like unbelievable. Like just going to, I mean, we just went to every one of his molecule to market guests on his podcast that he runs in the industry. We just contacted each of his guests and just said, hey, listen, we're thinking of creating a business. This is what it's going to do. And it was just a questionnaire about, you know, would you mind just taking 5 minutes? And we're happy to jump on a call and do this with you. We're not selling you anything because we haven't created the business. So we can't sell you anything. It doesn't exist. And that allowed us to really refine the opportunity, because so we created a business that was effectively what the market was telling us that they wanted and that they felt didn't exist.
This is very clever, Andrew, for so many reasons. So number one is you're involving them in the process of creating your business, which means they already feel invested, right? So if they actually had input into the offerings and how you're going to work with clients, then, you know, it doesn't guarantee they're going to give you business, but at least it guarantees you a conversation at least, right?
100%. Yeah. And that is exactly what happened. That is literally what happened.
It's awesome.
So we created the idea. We pulled it. What we did do though as well was we were really clear that, so I think we started actually in the March of 2020 was when we actually started in the business. I think I started full time and taking a salary.
That was very early during COVID. So like, you must have made this decision to leave your previous employer and start this business and then get up and running pretty quickly.
Yeah, we did. But I think that's a really interesting comment that you made there, to get up and running. So what we did was we put our money in. We sort of said, right, here's our runway. Here's our runway. This is what it is. But what we were really clear on was that we were not going to go to market until we absolutely knew what we were. And we knew what our identity was, and we knew what our values were going to be, and we knew what the culture was, and we knew all those things, right? And the offering. Whereas the traditional approach in the more privately owned sort of startup recruitment world is, right, get on there, get a phone, you've got LinkedIn, you get some jobs on, you make some fees and you go. We didn't. We just committed quite a significant runway and said, that's our runway. But we're going to take real time to get that. So we did a soft launch to the market in the summer of 2020, and we didn't really get going in the market until probably the November. And that was actually when we won our first customer. So we spent all that time hiring some people, some key people that we felt would help us move the business forward, move the dial, but primarily we are going to get this business right. We're going to get it right. We're going to build the foundation. So when we go, but only once we've got the foundations. That's a bit counterintuitive to most.
It's very counterintuitive because, you know, especially in a start. Now, I guess this is a little bit different. You had an investment, I think. Is that right?
Correct. So
you put some of your money in, but then you had
Romana
partners.
Fiona. Yeah, absolutely.
And, but if in a sort of entrepreneurial business where you just have to, you don't have much runway, you just have to start generating invoices as quickly as possible, then you need to dive in and then improve as you go along. But you guys took a much more considered approach.
Yeah, we did. So we hired Tom Kirkpatrick was our kind of first sort of keynote hire. And Tom, who's now our director of client services, he's a director in the business. He's part of our exec team. Can't imagine the business without him. And I knew within 30 seconds of meeting him, this was the guy. And we were so engrossed in our conversation. We were sat at a cycling cafe in Newcastle on a park bench outside the cafe. Lovely day on the River Tyne. And I didn't have a car at the time because I'd got rid of my car, so I was without a car. And
why didn't you have a car?
Just because my lease was kind of up, and so I'd got rid of my car.
Okay.
And then we were just running one car, and because I was going to start a business, and so I was like, well, actually, I can save a bit of money, so we can do that. So I didn't get a car, and was working from home, of course, because it was COVID. My dad dropped me off and then sat in the car park and waited for... So Tom and I are engrossed in this
Your
conversation.
Poor dad sitting there.
Poor dad. I mean, he's like in his 70s and sort of he's still taxiing his old, very old son around. And we were sat having this conversation and really getting into the conversation around like what the business was. And Tom was like, this is incredible. I've had an idea to build a business like this. and you guys have, like, you've developed it even further. And so it was like this kind of serendipity moment, and we were both so excited. And I got back in the car and my dad was like, how did the meeting go? I said, oh, amazing. Absolutely amazing. I said, we're definitely going to hire him. He's super. What a great guy. And he said, did you see who was sat on the next table to you? And I was like, well, no, I was just too busy. He says, Harrison Ford was sat on the table next to
you. No way.
And I totally ignored Harrison Ford.
So, what was Harrison Ford doing in Newcastle?
He was filming, apparently, I think the latest Indiana Jones movie. And they filmed
okay,
chunks
hilarious.
Of it in Northumberland. And so, but he was, okay. he was cycling. He's a big cyclist. So he was cycling around the Northeast. So he'd gone to the cycling cafe, got himself a bike, and him and his buddies, his crew, were going off cycling around. But apparently he was literally sat on the next table.
You were locked words. Into that conversation.
And we were locked okay. in the conversation. So I think, you know, going back to the question, what is the model? So we were very clear that we felt that the right model was not a 360 degree model. Over the years, I've just become really clear that I don't think that model works if you're trying to do a very high touch business model. So Tom was like amazing on the talent partnering, delivery type work. My experience is more evolved and sort of, you know, really maybe more developed around sort of networks and relationships and building those networks and relationships and helping businesses grow. And so it worked quite well together. And then we started scoping out, well, if we hire, and Tom's a biotechnologist, so he comes with a science background, which made him even better. So you've got that. So that kind of got that thought going as well. So if you look at this, so what we were really clear was we're going to have a talent partner group who are all about delivering unbelievable customer service to our customers. And despite the fact our business is called Lead Candidate, that's kind of the only reference we make to candidates in our business. We talk about customers who are looking to hire and customers who are looking to be hired. And so rather than that traditional value chain where the customers who are hiring at the top, the clients who pay the invoices, recruiters in the middle, and then the candidates at the bottom getting treated like fodder, we leveled the value chain and said, you've got customers who are hiring, customers who are looking to be hired, and they each have equal, equitable stake in the value chain. And our job is to just navigate that value chain and make sure that we are providing them with a service like they feel like they've got a coach, they've got someone in their corner, they've got a mentor, a career counselor, someone who provides like a level of service to them that just makes them feel like they're empowered to achieve everything they can as a person. And then the customer over here feels like that they've got someone who's truly embedded in their business and actually, you know, frankly, gives a shit about what they're trying to do and really helps them evolve strategies, but also feels that they've got someone who's going to push them and challenge them and say, listen, I think you're off the mark on that and this is the reason why, and help them understand that. And you know, and that's why our first ever customer, we did something that we called a capsule project. So it was a single important hire for them. That turned into a small scale project, which is our next level of service. And then that turned into a recurring annual agreement. So like I'm now going to tell you about the pricing model, how we do the pricing. So we kind of land and expand with our customers is typically what we do. The pricing model, going back to what Fiona said when we were figuring out the business, Fiona said to us in a meeting when we were all kind of talking, Tom was on board by now, we were talking about what's this business going to look like. And I remember Fiona saying very distinctly, and she said, she went, if all we can do is create a pricing structure that is a percentage of an annual salary split into three installments, then we have failed. We are going to...
Because that's what everyone's doing.
So everyone does. So everyone does. She went, you know, I started in business in late 1980s, early 1990s. That's what they were doing then. And it's not changed. Like and I always felt that when we were growing, I always felt that the only people that were benefiting from the growth were the recruiters because the percentages rarely changed. And I felt like I was paying a tax on hiring. Like it just didn't sit comfortably
hiring
with
tax,
me.
Hiring tax, yeah.
Hiring
I've
tax.
Heard I was clients like, use yeah, that term before.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, love it. Like, love it. So what we decided to do was just to be really clear that we were going to do a fixed project cost on every project that we do. So every cost is customized to the customer depending on their needs. We aggressively, ferociously look for economies of scale. So if we're working on a scale project, there are obvious economies of scale. And if there are economies of scale, we pass them on to our customer, and we are, you know, unapologetically open about that. And in some cases, we show them where there is an economy of scale, and we're going to pass it on to them and what that means for them in terms of the cost, the overall cost structure. But then what we do is we put a subscription together. So our smallest subscription is 3 months. So some people would say, well, that's just the same as three installments, but it's not. It's a subscription. It's not typically done on you know, retainer fee, shortlist fee, completion fee. It's we base it on sort of the nature of the project, and some people only want a 3 month subscription, but our average subscription is 6 months. And so we build a subscription and we put the subscription in play, and that cost is fixed. And that's really important in this part of the industry. And to your point at the start, the industry's done this where the market's absolutely boomed, and then it's flatlined a bit, and some parts of it are absolutely tanked. The certainty of spend and certainty of cost and transparency of cost for CFOs of private equity owned businesses, it's like absolutely critical to them, because cash runways are everything for these businesses. They could be building facilities, they could be installing new capital expenditure. Their cash runway is the lifeblood of their organization. So cash is king. And if we can perhaps support in that, then that responds positively. But equally, it also shows that we're sticky. And so the subscription gives them that confidence that we're not just going to finish the project, fill a job, and then clear off. They know that we're going to hang around. So it doesn't mean that a 6 month subscription means it's going to take us 6 months to deliver the project. Might take us 2 months to deliver the project, but we're going to get paid over 6 months. And so we sort of took that burden on as a business, and we felt that was our way of putting our skin in the game and putting our money where our mouth was.
Okay, this is super interesting. So the 3 month, is that what you call it, the capsule project?
Yeah, typically a capsule project, yeah.
And then what's the 6 month called?
They're called scale typically. It's where it's anything north of three hires, we call it a scale project. And the, you know, typically the minimum subscription is 6 months, but we've got subscriptions that run for 10 to 18 months.
Okay. And then for the subscription, is it based on a certain number of hires, or is it based on you allocating a certain number of talent partners to that project, or how do you price it?
Yeah, a combination of the two in all honesty. And we also look at the nuances of the roles, right? So how you price a scale project where you're hiring maybe five of the same people? Well, there are some economies of scale to be had there. You can definitely pass on some benefits. And how you price that is maybe different to a customer coming to us and saying, we're going to build the leadership team of a new company that we're buying. So we need, you know, one of these, and they're all fundamentally different types of positions. How you price that's very different. So we look at the merits of every single case, and again, very participative process. You know, we involve the customer in these discussions and say, hey, this is what we're thinking. Here's a starting point, but this is a starting point. So let's discuss it. You know, and give them the idea of what they're going to get. And as long as we can demonstrate that there's value, so in terms of percentages, right? I'm not going to say here that we don't look at, because we do. I'll be naive not to. Because when we're trying to think about, okay, how are we faring against some of our competitors who are maybe more the transactional 360 degree type models, like we have a good understanding and barometer of what the market average is. So we can then assess our cost versus their cost. And not always, but you know, especially with scale projects, because we're quite, you know, as I say, unapologetically open about passing on those economies of scale, you know, we can be 20 or 30% more cost effective than a contingent model, but actually we're providing a ton more value than what you get with a contingent model. And so actually, it's not, more often than not, we're not competing on price point, we're competing on value. And we can demonstrate what you get with us versus what you get with them. It's quite significantly different.
Fantastic. So just to recap where we are, so you started out with a very clearly defined niche market within life sciences, and then you consulted the market to find out what they would value in a recruiting partner, and then you created a differentiated service offering that was really selling on value, but also benefited both parties, you and them, because it's this subscription model, which means they get clear fixed costs. They know they can project what their cash outlay is going to be, and you get the recurring revenue as well. So this is brilliant. So I had a follow-up question there. Yes. So in other words, you're each project you're pricing differently based on what their requirements are. So if they or need five of the same people versus they need three or 10 very different things, you're going to figure out what the price should be. It could come in 20 to 30% less than them giving individual search assignments, right?
Correct.
To
correct.
A search firm. And they also spread the cost out. So you might deliver that talent faster than the 12 or 18 months, but they're committed to paying that over that period of time.
Right.
What happens if, let's say they say, we need to hire five, whatever, and then they end up wanting six?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you, like, so is there an extra cost, or how does that work?
Great question. That's a really good question, and it's something that happens like all the time. A particular customer actually right now, who in the undertaking of us hiring six particular people, there was another rule came up in the structure that they decided to go live with. And it was close enough to what we were doing for me to just say with absolute confidence, we'll just do that. That's fine.
Okay.
So in my mind, that's where, and the guys hear me say it, if they've heard me say it once, and anyone who's worked with me has probably heard me say it, and I can't remember who I stole it off, but it wasn't me, but it was someone. I talk about making deposits in the Bank of Goodwill.
Right. I get that. Yeah.
So, and I ask them to apply common sense. So, you know, we don't do that for everything, and we don't do it for everyone.
Because some clients will really push.
They absolutely will. So what we've done is kind of given the team the autonomy to make deposits in the Bank of Goodwill, but we also ask that there is a cutoff point as well. So you've just got to manage that sensibly. And up until this point, the team have done a great job with that. But fundamentally, what we have done is, so that same customer with that particular one, they then came to us with another two or three. And so in that situation, it was just right, okay, well, listen, you've been paying this amount of money every month, and it's a guaranteed revenue. That's what we'll do is, looking at the amount of work that we need to do based on that, we're going to add another 2 or 3 months onto the subscription. So the subscription is just going to run for another 2 or 3 months. Are you happy with that overall cost as a percentage of what that's going to be? And yes or no. And so we just consult with them, but that's typically what we do.
Okay, great. So if the needs change throughout the engagement, for instance, that they actually want to hire more aggressively than originally they'd planned
flex
on.
It. We build flex into the agreement.
But do you flex in terms of the length, or would you add on more increase the monthly subscription?
Case by case, but we've done both. And it depends on the circumstances, right? Some businesses it's like, listen, we're going to give you more to do, and we still want you to do it in the required time frame, so we fully expect you to increase the amount that we're paying you every month because we're asking you to allocate more resource to get it done. Other businesses will say, actually, that would work better if you add it onto the end, if that's okay with you, and then we can live with that, and then that helps them. So again, very, very flexible and very collaborative, Mark, in terms of those discussions. But I think it's some people, you talked about the boom thing at the start, right? If you look at what our business has done, growth-wise, we've kind of gone against the trend line. So
tell me more about that.
In the first 2 years of our business was the boom time. And like Tom and I, there was just Tom and I. And we were in a little cupboard. We had an office by then. I mean, it's a bit rich to call it an office. It was a cupboard. It was a cupboard with some dead pigeons outside that smelled awful in the summer.
You had dead pigeons. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, we couldn't understand why the windows were blacked out and the windows didn't open. And then Tom eventually one day, it was a really hot summer's day, about July time. And we were getting ready to launch. And Tom was like, I'm going to have to open the window, Andy, because it's boiling in here. And so he opened the window and then we just got this amazing smell because, you know, the nets that they put for the pigeons, like to stop the pigeons sort of landing on the windowsills and stuff. And they just got tangled up in the thing and died.
Oh, my goodness.
But of course, they just rot. And so we had to shut the window because the smell was absolutely putrid.
The glamorous life of an entrepreneur.
The glamour, Mark. The glamour. And it was...
For anyone outside the UK listening, because a lot of our listeners in the US and other places.
Yeah.
So it does get hot in the summer in the UK. We're having a heat wave right now.
Right now.
But not kind of super hot usually. So the problem is a lot of old buildings have no aircon.
None.
When it does get hot, you are absolutely sweltering in the office.
So. Yeah. So I mean, 60% of our business is in the US. So our customers are regularly laughing at us because, especially when we're in the old office, and like our new homes are so well insulated that they keep the heat in brilliantly. So once the heat wave stops, our homes are still hot for a week especially when you go upstairs, the temperature just doesn't drop. So the market was doing, and we were kind of seeing businesses that we were competing with absolutely flying. I mean, just their growth curves like this, opening new offices, you know, and all this stuff on LinkedIn about, you know, congratulations to John who's just done $1 million revenue himself, and which I, you know, I have my view about those kinds of posts. And we weren't doing that. We were very, very, we kept talking about the tortoise and the hare. We were definitely the tortoise, but at the time we were not even sure we were the tortoise. We were maybe the sloth. You know, we just weren't getting anywhere, and we were just, you know, we got to our first business, our first customers. In the first 2 years, we basically washed our face, Mark. Like we broke even for the first 2 years, and that was all we were doing. And it was like, oh God, what are we doing? Like, are we doing the right thing? But we just, in Fiona and Roman, we had two investors and partners, and we'd added to the team a little bit by then. So we brought in Megan Peacock and Yaz Johnson. So Yaz to come and do marketing and operations. Megan to come on board as a talent partner. She was a talent partner who had never done recruitment or talent acquisition or anything. She was a chemist. She was a chemist from a lab. So we kind of, but like we just, she knew that her life wasn't going to be in a lab, and we could just see that she had something in her. So we took her on board, and she now runs our largest customer account. You know, she's
fantastic,
phenomenal success story. We were sort of like, oh, why aren't we getting it? But Fiona and Man just kept saying to us, you know, stay true to your purpose, stay true to your cause, stay true to your niche. Don't diversify, focus on what you're doing. It will come. And, you know, I was going out into trade shows and meeting people. I was having loads of wonderful conversations with people, but stuff just wasn't dropping and wasn't happening. And then 2023, 21, 22, break even, 2023 started to really, and then 2024 last year, we trebled the business. We trebled, and it's like every customer. So that was when the market was kind of going in the other direction.
This is so interesting because most recruitment businesses that I have been speaking to were the exact opposite. They were absolutely flying, you know, 2020 to 2022, let's say. And then 23, 24, things started like crashing almost. And it was like, their whole business fell off a cliff, and you did the exact opposite.
We've looked at it, and we're like, how do we do that? But I think it was because we had the courage of our convictions. We stayed the course. We were happy to just be very deliberate, as you said before. I think you described our approach as being very considered, And that was the same in those early years, you know, sort of really controlling the costs, being really, really sort of measured, being really considered, staying true to what we believed in, even when we were getting knockback after knockback after knockback. And it was, and then it just started to click, and we got, and one of our biggest, you know, one of our biggest customers now, you know, they had some significant success. They started to accelerate. We had embedded ourselves so much in that business that as they accelerated, we accelerated. And that could be replicated across maybe, and all the conversations that I'd had with people in 21, 22, when people were saying, hey, listen, we're going to work with you, but the timing needs to be right. It's good. You know, we like what you're doing.
That's so frustrating to hear, though, right?
Yeah, yeah,
because you're like,
it's not paying the bills.
That's great. Yeah,
right. It's not paying you. And you're like, oh God. And we built relationships with some key suppliers of services to us. And if it wasn't for them, Mark, I'm like, there were definitely moments where we would have had to have had a serious discussion about, are we going to survive this? But there was enough direction of travel and enough confidence amongst the group to say, we're in now. Let's just keep going. And if we need to put a bit more in, and we did at certain points when it was needed. But then that's paid dividends because, you know, as I say, last year we trebled the business. We've had a team week this week. So the entire team has been here in the UK. So we've got someone who works for us who's based in Manila. We have someone based in North America. Raman is based in North America. Whole team's been here for the full week, and we've been doing culture. But we've got the stats. So I think we compared just with last year. So 2024 to 2025 comparable year. I think we've grown the customer base by 130%. We've grown revenue by 133%, and we've grown our headcount by 250%. And we've stayed true to the model, and we've stayed true to the how we're doing it, and that growth is not about, we're not turning into a volume business. That's just, we haven't adopted the model of, again, the traditional model in recruitment of hiring out a profit, hire a consultant, get them profitable, hire the next one, hire a consultant, get them profitable, get the next one. Because of the kind of service mentality of the board and what we were trying to build, we realized that actually we probably had to invest in the talent before we won the business. And so
you've got brilliant business partners and investors because they've seen this long-term vision that you're trying to create and bought into it. And because I feel like a lot of, for example, PE firms probably wouldn't have the patience to stay the course with this like long ramp to get to where you are. And so that is pretty awesome. But I will say also that the business model you have creates much more enterprise value. I don't know what your exit plans are. Maybe you're not even thinking of that yet. But the problem with permanent placements is the value of the business doesn't translate because there's no forecastable revenue. Whereas your model is fantastic because you've taken a permanent like search firm but turned it into recurring revenue. So that's,
we started, you know, at the start of the year, Mark. So we came into January, and in January, start of the, you know, January 1, I knew that we had 45% of our budget for the year as confirmed revenue.
That must just feel like such an exciting way to start the year, right?
You're like, wow.
But contrast that to like when things were not happening as quickly as you wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me what was going on in your head, because I kind of feel like, as an entrepreneur, your constant companion is fear and self-doubt, right? Was that the right decision? Is this going to work, right? Because, so what was going through your head when...
All of those things, I remember we actually talked about this yesterday. I remember ringing Tom one day and apologizing to Tom and saying, I'm so sorry that I've pulled you into this. And, you know, you're getting married, you've just bought a house. And I was like, you know, so sorry. And then he was like, it's fine. We're going to be fine. And he was kind of like, he's a very calm, kind of cool guy. And I was kind of maybe a bit angsty at different points. And you know, I had the support of family around me and friends around me. And as you said before, the two guys on the board, but there were definitely moments where I was just thinking, what the hell have I done here? This is absolutely ridiculous. You know, this is just stupid. And we definitely had those moments. We've made a dreadful mistake. But again, I think I remember a moment where I was so busy and I was a busy fool. I was doing stuff that I shouldn't be doing. And this was kind of the decision when we took to hire Yaz as our marketing and operations manager. And we hired Yaz before we hired Megan. So we hired someone who wasn't going to be...
Not revenue generating.
Not a revenue generator. We hired Yaz before Megan. And that was because... So Fiona came to my house. She drove to my house. We sat in the kitchen and we got a flip chart out and a flip chart pen, and Fiona stood in the kitchen and asked me asked me about everything I did every single day, and we wrote everything down on the board, and then we went, what is it you should be doing and what is it you shouldn't be doing? And we circled everything that I shouldn't be doing, and that effectively created the job description for us to hire Yaz.
Listening should do that process.
That was Fiona. And Fiona's done that with Roman. She's done that with many other people who are very successful business people and entrepreneurs. But having someone like that who just jumped in a car and said, right, I'll be down. I'm going to be here. This is what we're going to do. And we're going to fix it. And we're going to sort it out. And Yaz is here. She's just had a 3-year anniversary. I said this to her in her review a couple of weeks ago. I can't imagine this business without her. She is the fabric of the, you know, you cut her in half. She is lead candidate. You know, she is just phenomenal.
By the way, if anyone listening wants to, there's a great book on this by a guy called Dan Martell. Have you come across that book called Buy Your Time Back? So we've created a time and energy audit, which is basically what Fiona did with you. It's like a, it's harder to do it for yourself, but you know, if you're a one person business, you haven't really got a choice. That's your, if people want, I'm happy to send that to you. Just reach out, connect@recruitmentcoach.com and ask for the time and energy audit. And we'll send it to you. I'll send you a copy as well.
It is an invaluable exercise to do.
So, Andrew, what's your go-to-market strategy? How are you getting appointments and winning customers? I feel like once you have the meeting and you unpack what you do and you're talking about the solution, I think you would have a lot of buy-in. But how are you even getting to that
conversations?
Point?
That's a great question. So in the early days, we leveraged the hell out of Roman's networks. And you know, that question about the survey. So when we surveyed the market and then we created what the market had told us, shock horror, the market bought. You know, they were at the right time. They were the ones who said, "Great, now you've got it. I want it." So we did that. So basically, our two routes to market were leveraging networks and referrals from existing customers. That was it. We didn't do anything else. So we did no outbound, nothing at all. When the market got more constricted, we trialed three, maybe four providers who did outsourced outreach sort of stuff to just say, hey, let's see if it works. Let's try it. And it didn't. I think it did the opposite. In fact, I think we got more negative messages back from people to say, this is clearly like a campaign sort of thing, system, blah, 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 copy paste, whatever. And it actually wasn't copy paste. It was, you know, we paid good money for people to curate that stuff. But so we found that didn't work. And what we found started to really work in support of what we were doing but you need the case studies to do it, is going and attending events and getting referrals to meet people in person at events on the back of the success that we had. So a couple of our customers, very well networked in the industry, they would make introductions and we would go and meet people. And when you're getting those referrals, whether it be from Roman's networks, whether it be from the networks that I've now developed, the networks that we have from the existing customers, it's just a warm conversation before you even start. Like, you know, and so our go-to-market strategy is, we never sell anything. We go and listen. So we're very, I think people realize pretty quickly that we don't go into these conversations with people. So we get into our appointment strategy to try and get appointments, use the networks, use referrals. So it's a warmer conversation, and then just listen, just accept the fact that you're going to have, the worst thing you're going to have is a lovely conversation with someone that you're not going to work together. But what have you lost? 30 minutes of your time. So that's an investment that we're happy to take. And so we do that. The only person who does anything like selling is me, until November last year, when we realized that actually what we needed to do to build our US business is have someone on the ground in the US. And so we hired a vice president to be based in North America, who came from the industry, who came with credibility. That was a big investment for us to make that investment, but it was the right thing to do, Mark. It was just... And so that I felt instantly that took a burden off me, because I had somebody else who talked like I did. And that recruitment process to hire that guy was 18 months long.
Okay, wow.
So we were introduced through a mutual connection in the industry. I said, you guys talk very in a very similar way. You should just know each other. And I've always been one of those guys to connect with people and meet people. I've met most of the competitors that I work against. Or work in competition with, and I'll happily sit and have a beer with them or a cup of tea with them and talk about what's going on. I encourage that. I think that's a really important thing to do. And so I met Brandon through that networking, and we talked for 18 months or so, and then eventually the time was right for us to actually say, "Hey, Brandon, would you like to come and work for us and do this with us?" And he was like, "Thought you'd never ask." So now we've done that, and last month I added two customer development people to the business. So we've actually just hired two guys who are coming into the business, who joined 3 weeks and 4 weeks ago, so they're fresh into the business to help put some structure and some volume around the work that we're doing. But it's the go-to-market strategy, Mark, is going to be the same. It's not going to be any different. We're just broadening the networks.
Interesting. Very interesting. A couple of things I wanted to pick up on there. One is your story of how you hired Brandon. I think for those key senior hires, that is absolutely the right way to go. We do something, in fact, I would love to ask you I'll ask you about it after we record, but basically we get I invite people from my network to come and do a private Q&A for our customers, and we had a guy recently Justin from Norwood Staffing in Atlanta. No, sorry, not Atlanta. He is in Austin, Texas. And he's been on the podcast twice. He's scaled his business to 23 million, about 50 employees, just phenomenal success story. And so he was doing a private Q&A session for our members. And he had said, like, he'd hired one of the key hires that was pivotal to his growth was someone who he had been kind of, you know, nurturing for 2 years before they came on board, because, you know, that person, the timing wasn't right and they weren't at a stage where they could make it work. But, you know, they just kept the conversation going. And then that person has had a massive impact. So that makes sense.
I mean, it was huge for us. It was a huge investment. So we kind of, it all, and of course he's in the States and we're here. So it was all this kind of virtual stuff. And then I met him a couple of times in the US. Roman and I were at a conference together. So we got Brandon to fly up to see us. And we had a couple of beers together and had a breakfast together and just got to know each other as people. And because the culture fit for us, so important. Like, we have hired people before who have come from the recruitment industry and it's not worked. So we have made mistakes. We have hired people who, you know, for whatever, and it's not because they're bad people or they're not very good at their job. It's like not that at all, actually. It's just we're not right. Like, we just don't fit. And that was it. And like most of the people who have been in our business and have subsequently moved on, we're still friends with and we're still, yeah, we still keep in touch with them. It's just, you know, there's no, like, it's not like sort of, you know, that we don't like them. Far from it. But that was so important. And it's really interesting now that despite the fact that Brandon's on the other side of the Atlantic, he is like he's already like a cultural enhancer. Like, he adds, like, the team love him. Like, they go to him proactively for advice and guidance. Like, all that sort of stuff, despite the fact he's 3,500 miles away, that actually hasn't come into play at all. But I put that down to the fact that we were so considered and careful in our hiring of him.
Amazing. By the way, let me throw an idea out here. I think your go-to-market strategy is good. And the events, like, we hear from our clients that attending in-person events is been one of the best ROI things that they've done. And out of everything that they've tried, that's one that they are sticking with, is getting in person at industry events with your ideal clients and just showing up consistently. So I think that's a great strategy. The cold outreach is, there's an art and a science to it, and it is very difficult to get it right. And most people do it badly, and which is why it doesn't work. You can definitely make it work. And I think the secret is integrating some of the other things you're doing with your outbound. So for example, one outbound campaign that works really well for our customers is around events. So it would be an automated LinkedIn campaign to people in your network who are of the right profile to say, hey, Andrew, are you going to be at XYZ conference next month in Boston? Because, you know, if you are, it'd be great to catch up, grab a coffee. And if you're not, you know, but you'd value a conversation, let me know and we can make that happen, right?
I actually agree with you, because that is probably the one area where we have definitely had success with outreach, is when we've attended events. And the other thing we did this year, which is the first time we've done it, is the night before a big event starting, we hosted our own event as a kickoff to the event. And because we knew people were traveling into New York for the event and they'd come in the day before for the event to start on the Monday. So we did something on the Sunday evening, informal drinks event, got one of our big customers to come and do a keynote. And so it brought people into the room, and we got like 30 people, 40 people, all from the industry, all who, you know, some who are customers, some who aren't. But you put those people who are customers with people who you would like to be customers in the room.
Oh, brilliant.
You don't need to sell, because they do it for you.
Yes, exactly. So that's the kind of thing that Outbound is great at as well.
Yeah, I agree.
You can't sell your entire solution through an email. That's not going to work, right? But what you can do is make a very micro offer, like, hey, we're hosting this event. Love you to come along. We've got the speaker, some free drinks. Would you like to come? Like, that can definitely work in a cold email campaign. And, you know, it has to be very targeted. But anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but I love talking about sales and marketing strategies. So
no, absolutely. And I think as we've grown as a business and as we continue to grow and evolve as a business, we're going to have to open our minds to that. I mean, so one of the parts of our week this week was Innovation Day. It's actually called Tom's Day of Bad Ideas, which is Tom's session, because he's great at it. And it is just everybody sort of, you know, going, getting a particular grand challenge to think about, and how do we turn that grand challenge that comes from a different, and typically we don't look at the recruitment industry as a comparator, we look at other industries. So we look at what's happening in B2C, what's happening in e-commerce, what's happening in those worlds, and what are the lessons that we can learn and apply in our business. So for still a comparatively young business, I mean, we've done that for 2 years in a row now. So that
what's it called? Innovation Day.
It's literally called Tom's Day of Bad Ideas. That's okay. that is exactly what it's called. But isn't it? But the whole thing about it is innovation, and it's a full day of where we just think about things that we do, and we take it away, and there are some real tangible actions that we take away, and then everybody has responsibility to implement an element of that back into the business.
I love that. Is this a virtual or an in-person thing?
We've done it in person 2 years in a row. So we make a point. So there's part of this team week that we've done this week. Everyone's here and we've done it.
I love that. That is a brilliant idea. That's definitely, everyone can take that away.
Absolutely. Everyone should have a Tom's Day of Bad Ideas. And if you, I mean, I think Tom may have trademarked that, but feel free to.
Why is it called that? Is the idea like, we're just, it almost lowers the, like, it removes the inhibitions of people sharing ideas or feeling totally. Like, oh, this is probably too dumb an idea. Or
really, really tongue. Really, I mean, you know, Tom's got a very unique sense of humor. People who know him will know exactly what I mean. Who are watching this podcast, and he'll cheerfully throttle me for saying this. He'll be furious that I'm sharing Tom's day's bad ideas because he thinks it's his. But it is that. It's to remove the inhibitions. He makes it very lighthearted but serious at the same time. And actually, he started this year's session with the outcomes that we took from last year's session that we implemented and the benefits that it's had for the business. So it was actually brilliant. It was the right balance of hilarious sort of tongue-in-cheek humor. But actually, but by the way, you know, that stupid stuff we did last year, look at what we did and look at the value it's driven through the business and for our customers.
I'm going to definitely borrow this idea, because what I do a strategy session with my COO, Lisa, and we kind of do a quarterly kind of half day session. But I've got my whole team coming to London. We're hosting our own event in September, September 17th, 18th. We're doing an event for our clients. I'm going to have not our entire team, but I do have Rachel's coming over from the Philippines. Lisa's coming over from South Africa, and me and Sanjay are already here in London. We've got Christina coming over from the States. Maybe we should do that. So the day before we do the event, we should do our own day.
Do your own innovation day. Definitely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. So what's the sort of size and shape of the business as it stands?
Yeah, so today we are 16 people, including the board. So if you think about where we were, so we exited at the start of this year, we moved into an 1,800 square foot office in Newcastle City Centre, which is a beautiful grade two listed building, lovely light and air, a great environment for a team. And in the world of virtual working, I can't get my team to work from home. They all want to be in the office. Which is great because they all bounce off each other. A lot of our work is very collaborative. The office feels very collaborative. So there's lots of collaborative workspaces all around the office. It's not just lines of desks with phones and laptops. The team is 16 now, including the board. We've got Kat, who's based in the Philippines, who's with us this week. We have just hired a guy who's in Glasgow, actually. So we're looking at a small office space in Glasgow that we're going to take for him. And then we've got Brandon in the US. And unfortunately, Brandon's not with us this week because he has pneumonia. So he's definitely not well enough to get on a plane and come here. But other than that, everyone's here. So 16 people in the business. We're 78% of budget at half year, at the finish of the half year. So we've got a great pipeline of opportunity in front of us, got some wonderful customers. Everything we will continue to do is about looking after those customers and adding new customers who we think we can add the same or more value to. And that's very clear. We're saying no to more business, which I think is always a nice thing from a barometer.
Definitely. I think more recruitment businesses need to say no more often. What's the basis that, like, what's your criteria for deciding who's a good fit and who's not?
Yeah, I think we're starting to really get to know the ownership structures now. So, you know, maybe there are some private equity companies that we are perhaps more closely aligned to than others. So we'll think about that. We like to work with people that we know and we trust. If we don't know them and trust them, so there's an existing relationship with them, there's always a level of care around kind of engaging in those relationships. And then how we work. So if the customer is saying, hey, we really want to work with you, but we don't want to work with the way that you work, and what we want you to do is 25% success fee, da-da, we're not going to do that because we don't have to.
Okay, this is really interesting. Have you read, I've just listened to this book. As you can tell, I like listening to business books and stuff. Let me just find it on Audible here so I get it right. Built to Sell by John Warrilow. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so the idea was to run a successful, scalable, sellable business, then you can't customize your, like, do different, have all these different things and change your business model from one customer to the next. You have to be very clear on who you serve, what you do, and you do not deviate from that. So this is our model. And if clients don't, you know, they don't want that, then that's fine, but they're not the right customer for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are quite prepared to do that. You know, in year one, when we were just starting out, that was a much more difficult no to deliver. But we did it. We said no. Even then, we said no because we wanted to have the courage of our convictions. Now we feel more comfortable saying no because we've got that. We know that works, and we know that if you want a business to work like that, there's a bunch of other guys who work like that. Go and talk to those guys. And so I point them in their direction and say, well, hey, maybe go and talk to this guy, or maybe go and talk to this one. If that's how you want to work, their business is set up to deliver like that. Ours isn't. So this is what we do. This is why I think it's a good way to work. But if you just want to work like that, then just go to them. And we've had a couple of customers come back to us and say,
I was going to say, they've got to respect that, right? And then they may come around in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely two that I can think of as I'm talking to you now where they've come back to us and said, yeah, we've tried it, didn't quite work. Or they've come back to us and said, we've got some new work, and actually, while that works for that, we like what you do for this. So could we do this for that? So we've definitely sort of onboarded new customers and new projects as a result of saying no.
Makes total sense to me. I love it. But it takes guts, though. That's the thing. It's scary.
It did in year one and year two when we were saying no. Yeah, it was pretty frightening.
Every recruiter I speak to and every conference I attend, the big thing hanging over the industry is AI, and you know, how do we evolve in order to benefit from AI and not be, you know, made redundant by AI? What are you guys doing to integrate AI into your business, and what impact do you see that having?
I mean, it's what I hadn't realized naively was how polarizing this subject was.
Okay.
And I'm saying that from real-time experience yesterday in our innovation day, because as you can imagine, that was one of the grand challenges that was asked of the team was, what do we do with AI? And wow, some of the responses that came out of the team yesterday. I mean, I hadn't realized the environmental impact of artificial intelligence. Just water usage, electricity usage. I naively just had not even thought about that. One of our pillars of we built a strategy house when we started the business, which has five pillars, and one of them is social responsibility. And so there's a piece around that. We use AI. So we have a software platform called Quill, which is an AI machine learning transcription service. Great. Those guys are brilliant.
They have just come on board as partners with us.
Yeah, brilliant guys. Brilliant. Yeah,
Canadians.
Yeah,
actually.
Fellow Canadians as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're great. Lovely guys. So we onboarded with those guys really early. So that is a space where like the value that's driven through our business has been great. We've used it for, we have a platform called AssistCV, which was part of the Odro group. So those guys, and that's a CV formatting thing, which uses AI technology to help format your CVs in a very efficient way. So in answering your question, we use AI to drive efficiencies internally in our business, which allow our talent partners and everyone in our business to have more human interaction.
Exactly. That's absolutely the right way of thinking of it, I think.
Yeah. So we don't use it for screening. We don't use it for content creation. Our content creation is genuinely created by ourselves. There's a guy in the team actually who's dyslexic. He uses ChatGPT to kind of check his sentences and sentence structures and things like that. That was a really interesting take that he brought into the conversation yesterday. But you know, we have a dedicated marketing resource in the business now, so that content is genuinely created and curated by us, and to the point that sometimes we send messages to people and then we get a response back saying this is so obviously kind of ChatGPT, and the guys are really quite offended because it's genuine, it's genuinely not.
Well,
so we are using it to create opportunities to be more unapologetically human.
100%. I think that's a great way of describing it. What I would say, something you might consider, but definitely to our listeners, is the same exercise that you went through. What am I spending time on that, you know, I have to do that somebody else could do? You could do a version of that same
thought process and think,
yeah, okay, what are we spending time on, like recurring tasks and things that
could do?
It could be either done, it could be automated completely, or it could be enhanced with AI. And I suspect, Andrew, that actually your content, like your marketing person, could 10x their productivity.
100%. She does use it. Yeah, she does. She does. They do use it for different sort of activities and what have you, but nothing comes out of our business that is like 100% created by AI.
Yeah. That would be just drivel.
You can see it. You can, because it is out there. And I think what we're all getting much better at now is identifying what has been created by AI and what has been created by a person.
Yeah, absolutely. There has to be a human at the heart of all of your business processes, and particularly marketing or what have
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
So, okay, super interesting. So you're on that journey. We're on that journey. I think everyone is. We're actually in the process of hiring. By the time this goes out, we will have hired what we're calling a go-to-market engineer, a GTM engineer. But their job is basically going to be leveraging automation technology as well as AI in order to, you know, try and automate as many as our business processes as possible, but across all of our departments.
Yeah,
basically.
Those internal processes in particular. We've now got an dedicated operations manager, Susan, and that's one of the things that she's looking at in all of our integrated processes, invoicing, you know, credit control, all those things where you can actually afford to be, you know, we just, you know, you can be much more efficient and automate that sort of stuff. It's getting automated. So there's a big, but it's, as you will know, Mark, it's incredibly time consuming. It's like this stuff is like, it's like Pandora's box. Once you start, there's all sorts of stuff that comes out of it. It's absolutely fascinating to see. And again, that the Tom's to-do list that's going to come out of the session yesterday is extensive. It's extensive because, you know, the rate of change that we all live in today, it's just accelerating. It's just accelerating. Absolutely. And will continue to accelerate.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the vision then for the future of Lead Candidate?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So we've got our plan for this year. We've got the bones of a plan for next year. We are going to do a 3-year plan, and that's the first time we've done that this year. So that process has started. You touched on it very earlier. You know, what's your exit strategy? Is there an exit strategy? Honestly, there isn't an exit strategy. I don't want to work forever, Mark. I think, you know, and the whole reason we're talking is because you and I are of a particular age and we're a couple of years between us. So there will be a point, I suspect, where we'll need to think about those things, but I don't think now's right to think about those things. I think for us, we are just laser focused on doing an amazing job and looking after the people and the businesses that operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing sector and doing that with real care and class. And like, we're very, very focused on doing that. And actually, if we do that really, really well, we're pretty sure everything else will take care of itself. Still run a good business. And that comes from the pillars that we've set in the business to make sure those pillars are at the core of what we do, to make sure that our five pillars are financial stability, customer experience, social responsibility, innovation, and then growth. And so those five pillars will be what we continue to build the business on. And our vision is to create an ecosystem that benefits the people and organizations that operate in the pharma and bio outsourcing space. And that still remains relevant today. I don't think we'll add to headcount now for probably the rest of this year, but that's because we'll be getting ready for what's coming next year. And I think the industry is poised for another significant phase of change. So I think, I think we've definitely seen an uptick in activity around investment and capital being released and deployed. And you know, a lot of the private equity companies that operate in our space are still carrying too many portfolio companies. So you're going to see divestments, you're going to see restructures, you're going to see change, and all that change will stimulate a need for our type of services. That's a 3-year cycle at least. So we're going to keep on the journey. And the very worst in all of that, Mark, is that we'll still have a great business surrounded by really good people and we'll be enjoying coming to work every day. And if we can say that at the end of every day, I think we're winning.
I agree. That's a great definition of winning. Andrew, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a lot of fun hanging out with you.
I loved it.
We can do it in person sometime. We're not that far.
Well, yeah, it seems silly that we didn't do it in person. Because we are
well,
so close.
It's actually more challenging than you think. There's a lot more equipment and things involved, lighting, video cameras, all that. So this is not quite as good, but next best thing.
Next time we'll definitely do it in person and we'll definitely grab a beer. All right.
All right, Andrew. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks, Mark. Good to see you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.